Ha huagestig ri CGSF, nached poing aun FM, Crowley vo Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded September 11, 2024. Well, 11 months into Israel's genocide, and every day brings news of atrocities that can mean nothing less than the determination to erase entirely the Palestinian people from their homeland. Watching governments and the institutions of the West obfuscate and obscure the truth of this disaster as grotesque as the worst crimes of the last century, while too allowing war profiteers flourish by it, is a new kind of evil, one that damns us all. Last night, the candidates for the presidency of the United States presented to the people their case for election, but neither Donald Trump nor Kamala Harris could utter a word of condemnation of what Israel is doing or provide any promise of bringing this horror to a stop. But how could they, when America is the engine driving this Holocaust? Dimitri Lascaris is a journalist, lawyer, and longtime activist for social justice. He's been traveling extensively in and reporting from West Asia for several months, most recently in Lebanon. His articles from there around the region and from his home base in Greece are available at his site, DimitriLascaris.org, and you can tune in to his interview program, Reason to Resist, on Rumble, YouTube, and Twitter. Dimitri Lascaris in the first half. And as Gaza suffers bullets and bombs, deprivation and disease, its chief tormentor has turned an eye to the West Bank. Thousands have been rounded up as prisoners already, sent away to the infamous concentration camps where unspeakable crimes are committed every day, as they have been since the beginning, only amplified many hundredfold times. That method of Israel's genocide, its modus operandi as seen these terrible months in Gaza, is repeated itself now in the rest of the occupied territories. Salam Hamdan is a Palestinian political activist and social feminist. She's been reporting the increasingly desperate situation in her West Bank home for months, where arbitrary arrests and random assassination are the first and favorite tools of the terrorist state. Salam Hamdan from the center of the maelstrom in the second half. But first, Dimitri Lascaris and Finding Reason to Resist. Welcome back to the program, Dimitri.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, Dimitri, you reported Monday about the murder of American activist Isinor Ezgi Aigi in the West Bank by Israel. You question why current and past U.S. administrations repeatedly allow the sacrifice of its citizens by Israel with impunity. What other avenues, Dimitri, of redress for Israel's crimes is available when home governments fail to act in this way?
There are a number of possibilities. One of them would be that a state bring an action against the state of Israel at the International Court of Justice. Individuals cannot do that. So there you would be reliant upon, you know, the goodwill and commitment of some other national government. Then there is the International Criminal Court. If it rises to the level of war crime, and it's really, there's no doubt that Israel has committed war crimes in killing many citizens of the West, including Isinor Ezgi Aigi on September 6th. So the ICC prosecutor, if he had the wherewithal to do it, could bring a war crimes prosecution. And in fact, the current one, Karim Khan, has done that finally, belatedly, I suppose, with respect to Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant in connection with the genocide in Gaza, although he doesn't actually accuse them of genocide. So there's that prospect. You could potentially bring an action in the domestic courts, but there you would run into issues of jurisdiction. You know, the Canadian court might say, under a doctrine called forum non conveniens, it's a Latin term which basically means the convenient forum. The Canadian court might say that the more appropriate forum for this claim would be to go to Israel. You know, regrettably, Canadian courts seem to think that you can get justice in the courts of Israel when you are victimized by the state. So that could be a problem. And you could also encounter other arguments, including the doctrine of sovereign immunity. Israel would say our military was acting in the course of, you know, its responsibilities to the state, and therefore we are immune from suit in the domestic courts of Canada or the United States for this. The United States also has something called the Alien Torts Law, which could be employed. I'm not that familiar with the law. It has been used in the past against non-Western states like Iran. I'm not sure. I don't know enough about it to say whether that would be an option in the instance where Israel murders an American citizen. But there are a number of avenues. All of them present particular challenges. And ultimately, the easiest way and the surest way to get justice is for Western governments to protect their citizens by saying that if you do this, we will stop supporting you. We will stop providing military equipment to Israel. We will stop providing economic aid to Israel. We will stop providing intelligence sharing to Israel, and so forth. That would ensure not only that justice is done to the families of those who have already been killed, but that killings of this nature are prevented in the future.
Well, and how about for Canadians, if this was in the case of Canadians, and there has been Canadians killed by Israel, most famously perhaps Canadian Forces Major Petta Hess von Krudener, Blue Helmet, was killed in Lebanon in 2006 when Israel dropped a bomb on a peacekeeping station. They said it was accidental, as they say, incidentally, with Eisner's death, too. Israel says, oh, she may have been hit by a ricochet or some such, but she wasn't targeted, shot between the eyes by the looks of it.
And there also, sorry to interrupt you, Chris, there's also, of course, Jacob Flickinger, the World Central Kitchen aid worker, who was murdered by Israel along with six or seven other World Central Kitchen aid workers in Gaza this year. And he was a dual Canadian-American citizen.
Well, what does his family, and what about the family of von Krudener, what avenue do they have to go after the Canadian government and because they're not performing their due diligence in protecting their citizens? Because had the Canadian government made a big issue of the peacekeeper's death in 2006, maybe other Canadians would have been spared down the road. Can citizens go after the government and say, well, you're not doing the job that you say you're meant to do, which is protecting Canadian citizens?
Well, you could, in theory, but the government will almost certainly trot out some tired explanation, scarcely credible explanation, that it actually did attempt to obtain justice, and it did what it could by, you know, pressuring the government of Israel. And you'd have to persuade a court that that was not adequate. And courts also are reluctant to get into judgments about national security issues. And the government would almost certainly say that this is a national security issue and the court should stay out of it. So that, you know, I wouldn't rule out that possibility, but that is not likely to be, I think, an effective course of action.
Well, and of course, the White House has brushed off Eisner's death, and saying that they're waiting Israel to do an investigation, as they often do say. Okay, well, now I want to talk, Dmitry, about Reason to Resist. Now, your show, you talked with Gadi Francis of the Lebanese journalist recently. You've been through Lebanon. What's the situation? What's the situation there now?
Well, it depends on what part of the country you're in. So on the last trip, I went to northern Lebanon, and I went south of the Litani River right up to the Israeli border. In northern Lebanon, there is very little evidence of war. There is an economic crisis, which is affecting every corner of the country. But, you know, Israelis generally refrain from striking, for example, Christian communities. Not always, but generally they've refrained from doing that. So in the north, for example, there are Christian Maronite communities. You go there, you would never know, and I was in one of them, you would never know there was a war going on. On the other hand, if you go south of the Litani River, you can't escape the reality of war. There are explosions happening, audible explosions happening all the time. Sometimes you see the explosions. Sometimes they're perilously close. You can hear fighter jets going overhead numerous times every day, sonic booms being generated. You can hear, it's almost ubiquitous, the sound of Israeli drones. There's demolished infrastructure, particularly in villages bordering on Israel, Lebanese villages. The one village that I visited, which is 1 kilometer from the border with Israel, we got in there fortuitously because we happened to be in the vicinity. And this village, Aita al-Shab, which had been evacuated, was more or less temporarily reopened. Hundreds of villagers came back to attend the funeral of an Islamic resistance fighter who had been killed in an Israeli drone strike on the prior day. So we managed to see the destruction there, and it was enormous. I've never seen that level of destruction anywhere. I'm sure it's worse in Gaza, But outside of Gaza, this is about as bad as it's going to get. So it's really quite a few, very disparate experiences being felt by people in Lebanon, depending upon where they live and, frankly, what their religion is. That does impact, because of the Israeli selective strikes, does impact your exposure to the war.
Well, Hezbollah, the military organization in the south especially, they promised to go an eye for an eye with Israel when it came to these kinds of attacks. They fired uncounted numbers of rockets into northern Israel. Is that resistance being true to its word as far as you can see?
Yes. As far as I can tell, Hezbollah has been very disciplined. They put out a summary of their military operations every day. Typically, they will conduct somewhere between 8 to 15 military operations a day. They routinely identify the military bases they are striking. And oftentimes they will strike, I wouldn't say oftentimes, but from time to time they will strike a civilian building which has been converted to military purposes. So, for example, it's been converted into a barracks for some Israeli military personnel because, you know, the actual permanent military bases near Lebanon have become almost indefensible. So what Israel has done is it has set up in the military temporary military bases and command posts and barracks further away from the border. So sometimes Hezbollah will strike those. But based on its statements and based on the videos it puts out videos every day documenting at least some of these attacks, it appears to be consistently striking military targets, and it's doing it with a lot of effectiveness. I personally witnessed an attack on the Metula military base when I was standing atop a peak called Beaufort Castle in the south of Lebanon. Metula has probably been the Israeli military base that has been struck the most because it's at the northern tip of occupied Palestine, and it's surrounded on three sides by Lebanese land. It's like a little finger of land jutting up into Lebanon, and that base is extremely exposed, and it has been hit relentlessly. So I saw that, and they struck it with artillery shells, and then they pounded it with a thermobaric missile, which created a huge fireball. And I could tell myself that it was a military base because I was close enough to see it. So I think, and if you actually look at the figures, the statistics of casualties being given by the Israelis, there have been a handful, I think something like 12 civilian casualties, but the number of civilians killed on the Lebanese side is far greater. It's six, seven times, if not 10 times, what the Israelis claim they have suffered in terms of civilian casualties from these attacks.
Well, it seems that there's a differing attitude and strategy between the two sides. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dimitri Lascaris. Dimitri's a journalist, lawyer. He's a longtime activist for social justice. He's been traveling, as I said at the top, extensively in and reporting from West Asia for several months, most recently in Lebanon. Dimitri, I just got an email before we went on, a notice from Electronic Intifada, saying that YouTube has pulled their plug in some kind of punitive measure, citing community standards breaches, a common ploy used when they want to shut down certain people. Of course, September 11th is a particularly poignant date in the United States, and for those that would defend it. You were talking on your feed about moving over to Rumble. What about your move, and have you received any threats like Electronic Intifada just has?
The only it's interesting, Chris, because I'm actually befuddled that I've had so little action taken against me by social media platforms. I've never been removed from a social media platform. I've never been suspended from a social media platform. I had, I think, 7 or 8 complaints filed against me under a German censorship law with Twitter. Every one of those complaints was rejected by Twitter. By the way, all of those complaints related to my coverage of the Ukraine war. And the only time that I can recall that my material was removed was when I posted about a month ago on YouTube the video of an interview I had done on RT about, I believe it was about the Ukraine war. And YouTube removed the video immediately, not because there was anything in particular wrong with it, but just because they've adopted a blanket prohibition on RT content. They didn't penalize me in any way. They didn't give me a strike, but they did say, we think you probably just didn't know about this prohibition, but we just don't allow any RT content to be posted on YouTube. So after that, I started posting all, because I'm invited onto RT fairly regularly. I now post all of those on Rumble. I haven't had an issue. The reason why I went to Rumble is just because, you know, what's happening. For example, I didn't know about the electronic intifada censorship that you just mentioned. That's news to me.
I got that email at 20 minutes ago.
That is extremely troubling, because Electronic Intifada, in my opinion, is doing the best news coverage of any media organization in the English language anywhere on God's green earth about the genocide in Gaza. It's extraordinarily professional journalism. And they have been proven right again and again. They contested, for example, this claim that all of the civilians who died on October 7th were killed by Palestinian militants. They said that there was strong evidence that a significant number of them had been killed by the Israeli military. And now this is beginning to be acknowledged even in the Western mainstream media. This has been acknowledged in the Israeli media. They contested this allegation of systemic rape. They don't contest that there may have been isolated incidents of sexual assault, but this mass rape allegation, they've consistently contested it. And again, this is a controversy that is now seeping into the mainstream media, and the mainstream media is having to question the claims that there were mass rapes. So this is a very professional, very responsible, but also very committed media organization, Electronic Intifada. And if they have been removed from YouTube, you know, that should worry us all, whatever you think about the people of Palestine, however much you may or may not care about their plight. Because if they can do that to a professional news organization like Electronic Intifada, you know, any of us is at risk. I'm as rumbled just as a plan B. I mean, you know, at any moment, the hammer could come down on people like me.
Well, they say, and I'll quote them, YouTube has just placed a punitive freeze on the Electronic Intifada's channel, alleging that several previous live stream segments violated their opaque community guidelines. We vigorously reject this. Our careful reporting and analysis are professional, ethical, and factual. And they've got alternatives too, Twitter, Facebook, Twitch, Instagram. I don't see them on Rumble, but Rumble is definitely the CEO of Rumble fled fearing persecution from Europe just a couple of weeks ago. This is the current media environment.
Yeah, and Chris, it's funny you raise a subject with me, because just before this discussion began, I interviewed Sharmeen Narwani, who is an editor at The Cradle. It's an online magazine based in Lebanon, and they have been banned permanently from Meta. And that's what I was discussing with her. And one of the subjects that came up was, before the interview I did of her, I checked the distribution of users of Meta, and a huge number of them come from the non-Western world. They come from countries that do not consider Hezbollah or Hamas to be terrorist organizations. And the reason why The Cradle was permanently banned, according to Meta, is because it was praising quote-unquote terrorist organization. So what Meta is doing is it is profiting to the tune of billions of dollars a year from having hundreds of millions of users in the non-Western world, and it is applying Western standards to the content available to them, even as it profits from their usage of the platform. So this is, you know, extremely, it's bad enough, the censorship, but the fact that they're profiting from these people while forcing them to have to accept controversial Western standards of what is and is not terrorism. I mean, let's be frank here. You know, if we were serious about combating terrorism, our country would be sanctioning Israel at the top of its list, because Israel is the consummate terrorist state today. And yet we are allied with Israel, and we're sending weapons to Israel. So our whole question of terrorism and so forth is completely hypocritical, lacking entirely in credibility and integrity. And nonetheless, these social media companies are enforcing those standards on the whole world.
Well, more than that, it's an entire inversion. It's 6 is 9, up is down, black is white. This is the absolute opposite of reality. Dimitri, in that discussion with Narwani, is the popularity of Meta in the South, the global South, is that because of the WhatsApp communication phone app? And it's a deep penetration there?
Well, what I looked at was statistics for Facebook users. And it was interesting. The highest number of Facebook users is in India, almost 390 million people. And India does not consider Hezbollah or Hamas to be a terrorist organization. The second highest was the United States, which is about half as many as India. And third place was Indonesia, which also doesn't designate Hezbollah or Hamas as terrorist organizations. If you look down the list, in the top 10 or 11, there was Nigeria, Pakistan, Bangladesh. So why are these countries having to, you know, have their content regulated by social media platforms based on Western standards when they're you know, generating billions of dollars of profit every year for these social media companies.
Well, yeah, and those countries, too, are large population countries with large Muslim populations, too, incidentally, and some majority Muslim as well in the case of Indonesia. Well, so now the reason to resist, the moniker on top of your interview program, does that indicate a change of direction for you?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by your question. And certainly it's a change of direction in the sense that I have begun to devote myself primarily to my YouTube program. That is taking up by far most of my time. So I do practice law still, although that doesn't take up nearly as much time as my YouTube program. And also the branding, I don't like using that word because it's not, you know, this isn't about marketing. But the phrase reason to resist, I chose that as the title of my program with, you know, after considerable deliberation, because I've become absolutely convinced, Chris, that there was never a time in my lifetime when resistance was more needed than it is now. And resistance comes in many forms. We need to engage in all forms of resistance to bring to an end this genocide. We need to engage in all forms of resistance to oppose what, in my view, is rapidly escalating fascistic tendencies on the part of Western governments. And so I decided to make that the central theme of my journalism.
And when I mentioned earlier that it's getting the state of journalism, that we've seen arrests in Great Britain and in France, activists and journalists alike are being threatened, Sarah Wilkinson being a prime example of that. Canada can't be far behind. You've got two bases of your domicile in Greece, where I'm speaking to you from today, and here in Canada. Does this also mean you're going to be spending more time in Greece? Do you think that it's safer to be there doing the kind of work you're doing than it is to be here in Canada?
Well, in one sense, it is safer, I think, and that is that in Greece, there isn't you're not going to find too many militant Zionists or militant Ukrainian nationalists in this country. So, you know, there's not a lot of sympathy for Zionism here, there's not a lot of sympathy for Ukrainian nationalism, frankly. Most people are opposed to both of those things. So, you know, in Canada, one of the things my wife often tells me, you know, she's afraid of me walking the streets. I'm not saying that I share that fear, but she's afraid of me walking the streets in large Canadian cities because I've become an outspoken critic of Ukrainian nationalism and Zionism. And we've seen, you know, increasingly aggressive and violent behavior on the part of both of those constituencies. So I guess in that respect, I'm probably safer walking the streets. But when it comes to sort of my interactions with the government, Chris, the sad reality is that the Greek government is a vassal of Washington. And if the, you know, if Washington wanted to impinge my rights, you know, suppress my speech, sadly, I suspect that the Greek government would readily comply. The main reason I'm here is just it's more cultural and historical. I'm a Greek origin. I have family here. I identify very much as a person of Greek origin, and it was always a long life ambition of mine to come back here. So I now divide my time between Montreal and Greece.
The cradle of democracy, after all. The Democratic Party in the United States, they share your interest in the resistance, in the word resistance. They've dubbed themselves the resistance being to, I guess, Donald Trump and not to genocide that their party has been aiding and abetting. Even directing, I said, finally, Dimitri, I claimed in my introduction that the United States is the engine behind this Holocaust that we're witnessing in Palestine being enacted by their spear tip Israel. Do you think that's a fair analysis on my part?
Absolutely. I see no distinction between the U.S. government and Israel when it comes to their respective activities in West Asia. I think that the U.S. government talks a good game, and it says things like, oh, we're trying to restrain the Israelis and we want a ceasefire and so forth. But actions, you know, speak louder than words. It's axiomatic. And the actions of the U.S. government evince, and here I'm talking about these so-called resistors in the Democratic Party elite, they evince 100% support for every atrocity that Israel is committing. They won't even hold Israel accountable for shooting one of their own citizens in the head. What more proof do you need that they are on the same page? You know, and I watched, I think you know, Chris, that I have an extremely low opinion of Donald Trump, but I find it laughable that the Democratic Party is making these claims about Trump. So, for example, they claimed that he was going to weaponize the justice system against his political opponents. Well, that's actually what they did to him. They claimed that the 2020 election wasn't stolen. Well, I would argue that in a sense it was possibly stolen. What happened, I'm not talking about voter fraud. What I'm talking about is that at a very pivotal moment in the presidential race in 2020, it emerged that Hunter Biden's laptop had not only extensive evidence of depravity on the part of Hunter Biden, but there was significant evidence of corruption in the Biden family. And dozens of so-called intelligence professionals signed a letter claiming that this was a Russian disinformation operation at the time when the FBI knew that this was, in fact, Hunter Biden's laptop. Glenn Greenwald wrote extensively about this at the time and left The Intercept as a result of his opposition to this entire suppression of the Hunter Biden laptop. Now, I don't know if the outcome of the election would have changed, but I think it's highly, you know, if they hadn't lied to the public about the Hunter Biden laptop, nobody can say that for sure. But I think it is highly undemocratic for intelligence professionals to lie to the public in the middle of an election about a piece of evidence that could be material to voters' decisions about whether to support one candidate or another. That is profoundly anti-democratic, and the entire Democratic Party elite was in on the scam.
Well, what that laptop contained, it was damning of Hunter, but it was more damning of Joe Biden. And the fact that he was the candidate at all, the hanky-panky that went on within the DNC before that, he probably should never have been on that stage. It was pretty fishy all around. Thanks a lot, Dmitry, for coming on. I know you're busy. I really appreciate you coming on and painting the media house with me again. I wish you all the best. Can you lead us out with ways that people can get a hold of you and your stuff?
Sure. Thanks for that opportunity, Chris. My Twitter handle is at Dmitry Lascaris, D-I-M-I-T-R-I. L-A-S-C-A-R-I-S, no spaces. And my YouTube, my Rumble handle is the same. And my YouTube handle is the same, plus the number is 3051 at the end without any spaces. And those are the main places where you will find my reporting.
And go to DmitryLascaris.org, and you'll find links to all of that as well. Thanks again, Dmitry. And everybody stay tuned after the break. I'll be back with Salam Hamdan from the West Bank, where things are getting rather Gaza-esque right now. Thanks again, Dmitry.
Take care, Chris.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, as Gaza suffers bullets and bombs, deprivation and disease, its chief tormentor has turned an eye to the West Bank. Thousands have been rounded up as prisoners already, sent away to the infamous concentration camps where unspeakable crimes are committed every day, as they have been since the beginning, only amplified now many hundredfold times. That method of Israel's genocide, its modus operandi as seen these terrible months in Gaza, is repeating itself now in the rest of the occupied territories. Salam Hamdan is a Palestinian political activist and social feminist. She's been reporting the increasingly desperate situation in her West Bank home for months, where arbitrary arrests and random assassination are the first and favorite tools of the terrorist state. Welcome back to the program, Salam.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me back.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Salam, we're getting some of the news from the West Bank here, but not much. You've been to Canada. You know the kind of press we have here and what's available to us. Can you tell us what's really happening in the West Bank right now? What are you seeing?
Yes, Chris. There are many things that are happening right now in the West Bank, like multiple invasions and incursions, mainly in the northern West Bank, like in Jenin, Tul Karim, Tobas, and Nablus cities. Also, in addition to temporary incursions in Hebron district in the south, tens of people have been killed in the past couple of weeks. Yesterday alone, last night, 7 people were killed, 5 of them in Tubas City, 2 in Tulkarem. Not everyone killed is a fighter, actually. There has been a 13-year-old girl who has been looking